From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds and the incidental carbs you find in things like full fat dairy. Choose delicious fatty proteins and be free and easy with oily dressings on salad and butter on your veggies. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. You'll hear all sorts of ways to keto from my guests. There is no one way to do keto, no one size fits all. I hope to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we really can't give you medical advice. It's always best to consult your own doctor when making big changes to your diet and lifestyle, because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. Wouldn't it be helpful to have one place where you could find all the links? Want to sign up to my new Patreon-exclusive Facebook group, Daisy's Lovelies? No problem. How about subscribing to my YouTube channel? Please help me notch up my first 1,000 subscribers by going to links.ketowomanpodcast.com and following the YouTube link. Not following me on Instagram yet? Hit the Instagram button. You get the idea. All the buttons, all the links you need are at links.ketowomanpodcast.com. Thank you for tuning in to the first episode of 2020. Happy New Year. If you are new to keto or need a reboot, there are just a few days left to sign up to Kim and Carrie's keto coaching program, Happy Healthy Keto. You can find the link on the links page at links.ketowomanpodcast.com. This is episode number 115 with extraordinary woman Nadia Petaguana. Nadia and I met way back in early 2019 at Low Carb Denver, where she gave a fantastic presentation with Jason Fung. Nadia is a naturopathic doctor and dietary coach for the fasting method with Megan Ramos and Dr. Jason Fung. She focuses on metabolic syndrome and insulin resistance, expressing diabetes, obesity, fatty liver, and PCOS. Nadia is a speaker and author of the book The PCOS Plan, which is coming out in a few months. It is available for pre-order on Amazon, and I have put the link in the show notes, which you can find at ketowomanpodcast.com/115, along with all the info from this week's show. So, without further ado, let's get to that interview now. Welcome, Nadia, to the Keto Woman podcast. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing okay, Daisy. Thanks for having me. Thank you.
A bit full of cold,
yes,
I gather.
Yes, I am. So we've been sharing how we're both living in Europe. So it's humid and wet and cold, right? For me and you.
Yeah, me too.
And I've got two little kids. So of course they get the bugs at school and then they pass it on to me.
And that's exactly how I got the one I got a few weeks ago when I was in the UK and I caught it from one of my nephews. It's always the way, isn't it?
People that follow a low-carb diet and intermittent fasting, we're always very proud of the fact that we have strong immune systems, hardly ever get sick, except when you have two little kids and it's like that peak of fall in Portugal. I think you're going to get a flu.
Yeah, just that time of year.
Yeah, I think so.
Not nice.
Not nice.
So tell us a bit about you.
Well, Daisy, I think you and I met Was it in Denver?
It was.
Okay. So when we met in Denver, I had just finished doing my, I think, first presentation at a low-carb conference on PCOS.
Was that your first presentation?
Well, it wasn't my
first. I didn't realize it was your first one.
It was my first presentation at a low-carb conference, yes.
Right.
So I had spoken before. I love doing these podcasts. Mm-hmm. I had done quite a few presentations at like the Toronto Library and, you know, other informal things like that. And of course, I'm a coach for IDM and the fasting method. So I talk and talk all day. And as my husband says, I'm in my element. So I guess I'm a communicator. I love to learn and I love to share with people things that I've learned. So speaking is not something I'm foreign to, but it was my first, and it was a huge gathering. Remember, there was like 800 people.
It was
lovely. And I think that initially I was very nervous, but then I actually fed off of that and I enjoyed it tremendously. So I did this presentation on PCOS and fertility and metabolic syndrome and insulin resistance alongside Dr. Jason Fung. So it was lovely. So a little bit about me. I am a naturopathic doctor by training. I was trained at the Canadian College of Naturopathic Medicine. It's been now, I guess, 16 years since. I then went off to my home country. I went back. So I was raised in Canada, but I was born in Mozambique, which is a Portuguese-speaking country on the border of South Africa. It used to be a Portuguese colony back in the day. So my family is of mixed Portuguese and African heritage, and I had spent many holidays there as a kid, and I had this dream of actually working in Mozambique. And my initial goal was to work in the impoverished sort of countryside of Mozambique and learn a little bit more traditional medicine because I had done naturopathic medicine and biology. And so that was my initial goal. As it happened, when I went to Mozambique, that wasn't an option that was available to me. So the only option available to me was to open up a clinic and to practice. I wasn't able to work in the ministry, which is what I wanted. And so then I started a private practice, a little bit unprepared, to be totally honest, because that wasn't what I had planned for. But I was surprised to find out that in the city where I was born, and it's the capital of Mozambique, and it's a fun, very modern kind of city that you wouldn't maybe expect to find in that setting, but it is. I found that there's a very big population of people looking for weight loss advice and nutrition advice and diabetes advice and cardiometabolic sort of concerns. And that to me was a shocker. I was probably 25 years old at the time. I did learn pathophysiology. I mean, that is the bulk of naturopathic medicine. So I did know about disease, funny enough. And I knew sort of alternative medicine was our focus. So different combination of things to help people with different diseases. However, that's not what I thought I was going to practice. And I didn't prepare for it in the sense that Mozambique doesn't have the supplements and all the things that maybe other naturopaths would end up doing. So what I ended up doing then was, let's focus on diet. Let's focus on nutrition and see how I can help these people. And I always say that Mozambican people are a wonderful group, a very forgiving and wonderful guinea pig. So over the 10 years that I was there, I learned a lot from them and they allowed me to learn a lot from them. And so I sort of ended up developing this whole, my own dietary approach to their health concerns. As I said, the majority of people wanted to lose weight. I think that was which I was shocked, but Mozambique was just like any other city of the world. You know, people were eating a whole bunch of junk food and eating all the time. I did learn a little bit of nutrition in naturopathic college, but not in the way that we would want it to be. We learned about different vitamins, different macronutrients and micronutrients. And, you know, we didn't really learn about eat this with that if you have diabetes. And if we did, I think there was maybe closer to the conventional dietary approach than we would like. Maybe we talked a lot more about organic stuff or, you know, things like that. But really, I didn't learn a dietary approach to anything. And so I made it up as I went along. I used this base diet, as I used to call it, which was moderate, low carb. It was just a very healthy sort of like only eat these healthy things the majority of the time. And then I had these detoxes.
What is their typical diet in the area?
In Mozambique?
Mm.
Traditional Mozambican diet is a peanut-based diet. So they make peanut curries. And depending on what's available, you may or may not use a protein source. So if you have fish, you use fish. If you have meat of any sort, you use it. But a lot of times people don't have access to meats. And so they end up making this peanut-based collard greens kind of curry. So they get their protein and their fat from that. And then they have it alongside like the corn type of pap, as it's called in South Africa, which is like a polenta type of meal with a curry. So that's the traditional Mozambican diet. And people still eat that, even in the city. But it's something that's probably eaten more on the weekends because it takes a long time to cook. Right. And so during the week, people just eat a combination of things. There's a big Portuguese influence, as I said. So there's a lot of Portuguese food. There's a huge Indian influence in Mozambique. So people eat a lot of Indian food as well. But really, there's a lot of junk food, as I said. People drink Coca-Cola more than they drink water. Mm. A lot of alcohol, to be totally honest, a daily event. People drink alcohol daily and they drink Coca-Cola daily, and just a lot of snacks, as we do, right? Some people are trying to do healthy snacks, some people are just snacking. So it's just a lot of eating all day long, to be totally honest. A lot of people still go home for lunch and dinner, which is lovely. There is that component, but there's just a lot of everything, right? That people just eat a lot all the time, and not the best foods, of course. And then, of course, they have fallen victim to the low fat craze as well. Trying to eat low fat, to compensate for that, they end up eating a lot of other things that they probably shouldn't. There's a lot of seed oils that are used to make these curries. And there's a lot of course, grains, as I said already. But so those that can afford rice and buy rice will have a lot of rice, a lot of bread. And that's not the worst, of course. The worst is everything else. It's all the other packaged stuff and the seed oils that they eat and the Coca-Colas, like I said. Mm-hmm. Just a whole bunch of everything. Kids are just constantly eating all the time. They're snacking all the time, just like everywhere else in the world, here in Europe and North America, as you know, Daisy. So it's a combination. So and I now think that they're victimized to the whole globalization. They eat their own food, yes, but they eat everything else as well. And they eat all the time. I think that's the underlying thing.
Yes, and that's such a key component of what you do now, of course.
Because I work for an intermittent fasting program, and really that's what we're saying. We're saying, you know, we're very inclusive to people's dietary choices. And many, many people have their different thoughts of what they think is a good, healthy diet. And we're very supportive of that. Of course, with some guidance, we have some sort of foundation to what we believe to be better food choices. But really, it's the intermittent fasting component that I think is key to health, in my opinion. And I'm glad to have fallen sort of into this path. So this is 10 years in Mozambique. At some point, I realized and I sort of got the reputation for helping women get pregnant, even though that wasn't what I intended. What ended up happening was that a lot of women that, of course, had metabolic syndrome or different expressions of metabolic syndrome looked for my help. And because I was the only person doing this in this big city, I had a lot of clients. I was very lucky. This was, you know, one of those when luck meets opportunity or whatever you want to call it, right? And so I ended up finding out that women were telling me that they had gotten pregnant 3 months after starting my dietary plan, even though they hadn't gotten pregnant for 10 or 15 years. Some very interesting cases, like the one couple that had been married for 13 years and had tried IVF for 6 or 7 years, then eventually adopted a beautiful little girl. And then when that girl was 7 years old, so they've been married for 13 years, they got pregnant twice after following my diet. And so it was, you know, the husband wanted an explanation. I didn't have an explanation to give him. I'm like, I don't know. I think it's the detox. That was what I used to tell people. It's a detox. You know, we're taking out all the junk and then people are detoxing.
So your reputation started to change and develop.
That's right. And a lot of people.
Weight loss to, something else.
That's
is happening
true.
Too.
And a lot of people didn't want to come and see me because of that. A lot of African women were like, we're not wanting to see this woman. We have like 5 children or whatever, 3 children or 4 children. We're hearing that people get pregnant and we're trying not to get pregnant. And so it was a funny thing. It was like, don't go see that doctor. And yes, go see that doctor. So still the overwhelming majority of my clients were people that were overweight and diabetic, just like today. And so 10 years on, I guess not fully at the very end, maybe 8 years on, I myself started struggling with infertility, and that was a shocker. So I had been this tiny, skinny little thing my entire life, tiny little kid, tiny little adult. I think I weighed 96 pounds when I went to Mozambique at 5'2" and at 25 years old. By the age of 28, 29, I was still like 97 pounds. But when my husband and I tried to start a family, I realized that I had some issues. First of all, I started gaining a ton of weight very quickly. I gained about 30 pounds in about 3 months, which because I was so thin, people thought, oh, you look great. Finally, an adult, and it looks like a woman, not a little child anymore. But I started to develop a lot of things, a lot of acne and hair loss and just overall very unhappy. after about a year of trying to conceive, I realized I must have infertility. And I, of course, knew enough to know there's some hormonal issue here. And I suspected PCOS, polycystic ovary syndrome. And I pressed my doctor about it. And he kept saying that I didn't have PCOS because I was skinny. I was so thin. And I was like, no, listen, this is happening. And then finally, he did some testing and ultrasound and blood tests. And I did have PCOS. Not only did I have PCOS, I had the Frank type of PCOS, which means I had all three diagnostic criteria. I had the irregular menstruation and really an ovulation. I didn't ovulate at the time. And I had the polycystic ovaries, so the cyst in my ovaries on ultrasound. And I had the expressions and the laboratory findings of excessive male hormones. So I had all three of these. And so I was happy to have a diagnosis, but I was very miserable because basically he prescribed fertility medication. Initially it was oral medication. And he walked me out the door. And he, as I was walking out the door, he said, by the way, by the next time I see you, you're probably going to be obese. You're probably going to weigh an extra 50 to 100 pounds. And this, he honestly said this as he walked me out the door. And I went home and I thought, I was miserable. I was very upset. And initially I thought, I'm just going to go and do IVF, in vitro fertilization, and get this over with. I want a baby. And my husband wasn't okay with that. And then I thought, okay, so what can I do? And then I remember that whole diet thing. I'm like, there's something here. Even though I'm not obese, I'm not overweight yet. I was gaining a lot of weight. And I thought, these women got pregnant because of the diet. There must be something there. I didn't know anything about the things that we now know, thank goodness. I didn't know the link between PCOS and diabetes, for example, and I knew about the infertility, but I didn't know about the dietary component of it. And so I went home and I thought, I'm going to do that detox that I give people, that the strictest of the diets, because if that's what's going to do it, that's what I'm going to do. And you know, the story, of course, I got pregnant right away. It was very quickly. Even though that was a wonderful thing, I didn't follow through with that. I threw the diet right out the window. I went through my pregnancy just eating the way that I ate before, which is terrible. Basically, my whole life, I snacked. I never ate full meals. I never ate meat and vegetables. Let's put it that way. So if I didn't eat meat and vegetables, I ate everything else. Okay. And in small amounts all day long. And that's how I ate. And I didn't realize I was developing this condition. And so I had a lot of pregnancy complications. I had a very challenging postpartum period. So after my child, and the 2 years in between my first child and second child were not healthy. They were a very unhealthy sort of period of my life. And as we decided to try for a second child, because my health was deteriorating and I'd had now these very large cysts in my ovaries, and my doctor thought, you're eventually going to have to remove these ovaries. You might as well try to have a child now. I was in no place mentally, physically to even think about any of this. So again, he prescribed fertility medication. It didn't work. I also didn't go on my diet because I couldn't even fathom thinking about it at the time. I was overweight at this point. And then I met up with a friend of mine, a gynecologist, and she said to me, of course, you're not going to get pregnant, not even on the fertility pills, because you have PCOS and you're insulin resistant. And that was the first time I made this link between insulin and PCOS. And that changed everything, as you can probably imagine. She did prescribe metformin, which I think probably helped me tremendously. And I did get pregnant very quickly again with my second child. After that child was born, I was in a, first of all, health-wise, I was in a bad place because now I had all the expressions of metabolic syndrome. I had hypertension, I had diabetes, I was overweight. I developed a thyroid tumor, which turned into a thyroid cancer. And this was all, in my view, related. And I had all these other things, postpartum depression, which developed into chronic depression, I guess. And I was on medication for that as well. And so when my second child was born, I decided that I had enough information. And there was enough information at that time, both professionally and personally, to make a change. And so at that time, I went full keto, full low carb, ketogenic diet, and I started intermittent fasting. So I started by eating two meals a day, two rich meals a day, very, very good, real food. I am a big fan of real food. I never got into the keto products or anything else. It was full meals. And in probably 3 months, I lost all the weight. I got off all the medications, including the depression and sleep medications and everything else. And so that to me was huge because it impacted me very deeply personally. And because I was in that field to begin with, there was no way I could ever go back to any other type of professional guidance or do anything else in life. So at that time, luckily for me, I was back in Canada and I met Dr. Fung at a conference, Dr. Jason Fung. He invited me to come into the clinics and meet Megan Ramos, who, of course, is our program director. And so her and I started working together. And so we worked in Toronto at the clinics. I worked there for a couple of years. I learned a lot, again, from all of these people that I worked with, particularly the clients, right? You learn mostly from the people that you work with. I already had the background. And most of the people I worked with, again, were diabetics and people with obesity. But there was a lot of women with PCOS. So it was just natural that this became a big thing for IDM as well. And Megan had PCOS as well. So this was something we shared and we knew a lot about. Then Dr. Fung and I decided to write the book, The PCOS Plan, which is coming out next year in 2020. And I started doing all these lectures and presentations, which I've been very lucky to have done quite a few now, I think. And our book is coming out very soon.
Fantastic. How exciting. Didn't know about the book bit.
You didn't? Oh, sorry, Daisy. Did I throw that on you?
No, that's great. It's really exciting. I look forward to it. When's it likely to be out? Next year, obviously, but when?
We are thinking April of 2020. So I'll be in Toronto at the time promoting the book, I think.
Perfect. You referred back when you were talking about your own diagnosis of PCOS, and you mentioned that there are different types. And I've actually recently interviewed Carolina Cartier, who also had PCOS. She developed it at a much earlier age than you did. But perhaps you could just talk a bit about exactly what PCOS is, how it develops, why it develops, and all the information about it for people who don't know.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you for that opportunity. So I think I developed PCOS quite young, to be totally honest.
Right.
And I think I was put on the birth control pill because of it. And I was just told to stay on it. Don't come off the pill, because I was a mess off the pill. So I stayed on the pill for, I think, 10 years, if not longer. So I am pretty certain I developed PCOS like most young women develop in their early teens. I showed a lot of signs of it. But again, I was disregarded because I was thin. I was a thin child and teen, but I had expressions of male hormones. I had the hirsutism and I had the acne and I had the irregular periods, very irregular when I was a young teen. And my doctor just put me on the pill and never talked about it, never looked into it. I was just told over and over to stay on the pill. And I myself realized as a young woman that if I was on the pill, things were a little bit more regular for me. So I just stayed on it. I didn't know enough to even look outside of it. And I never tried to get pregnant in my 20s. So it was never something I even realized. But PCOS, as you said, polycystic ovary syndrome, at this point, I find when I ask in lectures, most people have either heard of it or they know somebody who has it. It's very common. This is the one thing that we need to know about PCOS. It's very common. However, it is disregarded. I still speak to women today that tell me, whether they're in their late teens or 20s or 30s, I've had a woman just last week in her 50s get diagnosed by her doctor with PCOS. And the doctor said, oh, don't worry about it. It's nothing. And so it's disregarded. And so here are the key things for me. It's common. So we think it's the most common endocrine condition in women, at least in their reproductive years. So it's common. It's debilitating because all that comes with it. So we've talked a little bit about physically, right? It might express itself as male pattern hair growth or hair loss. You know, for a woman, that's frustrating. The acne. And then there's the fertility issues that women have. And of course, that's serious and debilitating. And then there's the much higher risk of cardiometabolic conditions. And I've mentioned a few today, right? Obesity, diabetes, hypertension, cancer, etc., maybe Alzheimer's and all these other things. So it's very, very serious, yet it's highly disregarded and probably misdiagnosed, so underdiagnosed. So it's serious. And women are being told that it's common, it's no big deal, there's no treatment for it. There's some medications to address certain aspects of it, right? Like there's the pill, of course, which will mask a lot of the symptoms in young women. There's fertility medication, of course, so women can take this if they're trying to get pregnant. And a lot of women with PCOS have success getting pregnant. Women with PCOS are not infertile. They just have fertility struggles. However, they're at a much, much higher risk, like I was, to having pregnancy complications. We're talking high risk of miscarriage and high risk of preeclampsia, high risk of gestational diabetes, high risk of postpartum and neonatal serious birth concerns. This is a serious condition. Absolutely. Yet women are saying, no big deal. You have PCOS, it's common and it's no big deal.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, why isn't it one of the standard things that women are screened for, particularly if they're having problems with fertility. But then I was thinking about that question, asking you that question, and as you were carrying on talking and saying that it's just dismissed, maybe that's why. If doctors are thinking there's nothing really we can do for this, so what's the point in screening and finding out you've got it in the first place? It just seems, when it's such, has such far-reaching effects, it seems crazy that more isn't being done about it.
Well, I do think nowadays women get screened for it quite a bit, especially if they're, when they go to a fertility, or at least first step, when you first go to your doctor and you have infertility, they do screen for it. I think as a young woman, sometimes it's screened for, sometimes it isn't, because there isn't very much that they're going to do about it, like I said. And really, it's just addressing the symptoms. This is conventional medicine, is you have this concern, there's this medication. That concern, there's that medication. So women with PCOS will take 10, 20 different medications throughout their lives. So I do think that when you're going through fertility struggles, it is screened. And it is, I think 80% of all the infertility cases at fertility clinics are PCOS, at least an ovulatory type. So the women not ovulating, 80% of them have PCOS or so. That's the estimate. And so it is screened for, but the PCOS itself is not treated, is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. It's not addressed. It's the expressions of it. So if it's infertility that a woman expresses, then they try to address that by giving women fertility medication. What's the concern? The concern is that these women are getting pregnant with this condition that has serious pregnancy complications and postpartum complications and baby complications. So we should be addressing the problem first.
Absolutely. So it's not just about the getting pregnant bit. That's, we tick right, that box. It's all the other things that come with it.
Yeah.
And the different types, you mentioned there are different types of PCOS.
So PCOS, as I said, is diagnosed by 2 out of 3 diagnostic criteria. So let's mention them again. The irregular cycles, right? The expression of excess male hormones and the cysts in the ovaries. So a certain number of cysts, because it is normal to have some cysts in up to a certain size. But if it's over a certain size and over a certain number of cysts, then it's called polycystic ovaries. And that is viewed on ultrasound. And nowadays with technology, it's very easy to see. So if you have two of these three, you're diagnosed with PCOS. But it is a diagnosis of exclusion. You have to exclude other things. There are certain conditions that can mimic PCOS. And those, and many of those are very serious as well. So they have to be excluded. And doctors often will do a good job excluding those, especially because these other conditions often will present with other things and maybe some serious other things. And so those are excluded first. If you have these 2 out of these 3 expressions, you're diagnosed with PCOS. Because I had all three, then I had the frank type, which is, if you picture PCOS as being a syndrome on a spectrum, so you can be at very different spots on the spectrum. I was pretty advanced on that spectrum. Right. However, I was thin. But again, obesity is not a diagnostic criteria for PCOS. You can be thin with PCOS and you can be overweight with PCOS. PCOS doesn't cause obesity and obesity doesn't cause PCOS. So why are they associated? Because they have one common link, which is insulin, high insulin, excess insulin. Same thing with diabetes, right? Diabetes doesn't cause PCOS and PCOS doesn't cause diabetes, but it does put you at a much higher chance or higher risk of developing diabetes as well as obesity. So even though I was in weight 90 something pounds, I eventually started to gain weight and gain weight very, very quickly. And a lot of weight. Eventually I was overweight. And so the link, what's probably very likely causing women to go up on the spectrum is insulin. The more insulin you produce, the higher up on the spectrum you're going to be, and the more likely as well that you're going to have these other associated conditions, right? And so I wrote an article for the Journal of Insulin Resistance, a review called "The Contribution of Hyperinsulinemia to the Hyperandrogenism of PCOS," which means how much does high insulin contribute to these high male hormones in women with PCOS? And if you do a review of the literature, it contributes immensely. It is the insulin that's causing the high testosterone, and not just high testosterone, which is the male hormone, but it's causing the liver to underproduce a hormone that binds to testosterone. It's called sex hormone binding globulin. So you have low of this hormone that binds testosterone. So you have an excess amount of free testosterone in women's bodies that are then expressing all of these conditions. So the higher the insulin, the more of this you have going on. The higher the insulin, the more irregular periods. So the more, because there's a localized effect on the ovaries, that affects both the cysts and the irregular ovulation. So insulin is behind all three of these major diagnostic factors for PCOS.
That's fascinating, isn't it? It just seems so obvious when you talk about it and when you delve into it. And I think that's what so many people find when they start eating low carb, keto, and they start looking at the science behind it and articles such as you've just mentioned writing. Everything just starts clicking into place. Oh, okay, so that's why. And it's that light bulb moment, isn't it? When you can find out what's at the root of it, what's the root cause? Because then instead of just taking various medications to treat all the symptoms, you've actually, someone's told you this is the root cause and I have a way to help reverse that. It's like magic.
This is it. And I'm so happy that you mentioned the light bulb moment. My light bulb moment was visiting that friend of mine, the gynecologist in Mozambique, who said, you have PCOS, you're insulin resistant. That was like, bling, finally, this makes sense. This is why so-and-so got pregnant after 13 years of marriage, and so on. And this is how I'm going to help myself and the people to come, you know, and all these women that are struggling. And this is it. We have a way, as Dr. Fung would say, if the problem is insulin, then the solution is to lower insulin. And we know how to lower insulin. I think a lot of your listeners know how to lower insulin themselves. And that's, I often start my presentations by saying this, you know, PCOS, very common, very serious, debilitating. But guess what? You all know how to treat it. How great. You know, you all know how to help all these women. Because I ask everyone, people in the audience, any of you have or know someone who has PCOS? And almost everyone puts up their hand. And then at the end, I say, guess what? You know how to help them. It's that simple.
Talking about that end of it, how effective is it? And is it, again, a bit of a sliding scale? Does it depend how long you've had it, how high you are up on that spectrum? It's such an open-ended question, and I'm sure there isn't one specific answer, but how quickly and how well are you seeing people? Can they completely reverse the condition, or is it just a case of alleviating a bit? How does that side of it work? Once you've given them this information, what happens next?
You know, I think that's a wonderful question. And people often ask that about diabetes and PCOS, right? Can you reverse the condition? And the truth of the matter is, as long as you keep insulin low, then the expressions of it are away. But you, just like you know how to lower insulin, you also know how to raise insulin. So if you choose to raise your insulin again by eating all day long and by eating certain foods, yes, you can produce PCOS again. You can produce diabetes again. And so I will use, of course, I'm very lucky to work with many people. So I know it's not N equals one, but I use my example because I think it's a good example. It's a very obvious example. So I am turning 42 in 10 days. As I said to you, I've had this condition since my early teens, although it wasn't diagnosed and it wasn't, but it did progress onto the frank sort of tip of the spectrum. I mean, it probably got, I'm not going to say as worse as it could, but you know, I tick all the boxes, as you said, right, Daisy? And so it was pretty bad for me, I think. When I had my second child and I decided to do all this, then my concern was I don't want a third child, not now anyway. And so we decided that we needed a method of birth control. I ended up inserting an IUD, like many women after they've had children will decide to do. Unfortunately, at the time, I don't know that I chose the best method, but I chose a hormonal IUD at the time. It just was what I was recommended, and that's what I did. At that point, all I wanted was to not have a child. And so for 5 years, actually 6 years, I was only supposed to have it on for 5 years, but anyway. And so a few months ago, I removed this IUD, and I've shared this again. I share my story only because it illustrates many women's stories. And so at 42, after 6+ years of following a low carb and intermittent diet lifestyle, it's not a temporary diet. It's not something I did to reverse PCOS. It's something that I choose to do for my health and for my well-being. I feel better on it. My skin looks better on it. I mean, these are all important things for a lot of people, but I, you know, it's important to me that I don't go back on. Remember, I was on hypertension medication. That's a very serious thing. I don't want to be on hypertension medication. I was on diabetic medication. I don't want to be on that. So I follow this lifestyle. Plus, it's the first time I eat real food in my entire life that I can eat a meal, that I can eat meat and vegetables. I couldn't. All I wanted and could eat were carbs all day long, sugar. I had a terrible sugar addiction. as many people that you probably speak to have as well. So long story short, my doctor says, hey, hello, it's been 6 years. You now need to remove this IUD. You can't have it in for more than 5 years. And now I have to choose what to do next. And I'm not sure what I want to do next. Now I'm full of questions in my mind. So we thought, let's just remove it and see what happens. And for the very first time in my life, and I'm almost 42, 28 days after I got the IUD removed, I got a period. 28 days after that, I got a period and checked my ovulation at 14. And it's so like textbook. So when you ask, can it be reversed? I don't know what you would call my condition, my specific situation, but how am I getting a period every 28 days and getting ovulation at 14, you know, and now I have to worry about how do I prevent myself from getting pregnant? But it also leaves me wondering, if I did have a child now at 42, wouldn't it be a much healthier pregnancy than my previous two?
Yeah, absolutely. When you talk about this whole reversing the condition, and different people refer to it in different ways, and can you reverse it? Whatever. The fact is, as you were saying, you can remove all those expressions, and as long as you maintain it, carry on eating that way, it's not going to come back. So, I mean, effectively, it's gone as long as you do that. But it's that whole thing when you talk about lifestyle, it just made me think about when you were talking about your first pregnancy and how you did what you did, change your diet to get pregnant. And then it was like, well, I've done that now and I'll stop. And it just reminds me of all those diet days, you know, follow this diet for 2 weeks to lose a dress size or to lose however many pounds or whatever it is. But it's this finite block of time that you're going to do this diet. And then you go back to whatever you were doing before. And that's the problem bit, isn't it?
It is. And intermittent fasting is not a diet. It's a lifestyle. And I have to tell you, Daisy, that even though I followed a ketogenic, quote unquote, diet by macro count definition for quite a few years, I don't know that my diet right now is, quote unquote, a keto diet, but it is ketogenic, meaning that I stay in a ketogenic, fat burning, low insulin state because I check, I have a way of checking it. And that's really what I care about. I don't care if my diet is, quote unquote, keto or not. I care that my insulin stays low. And so I'm able to do that with intermittent fasting. And of course, so long as I probably follow a proper real food kind of diet, which I try my hardest to follow. I'm human and I have my exceptions. But the intermittent fasting component makes it so that my insulin stays low, really, no matter what I eat, because of the way that I eat. And that's ultimately the message that I try to give women. The lower carb ketogenic diet is a great healing and a great way to reverse diabetes, obesity, PCOS, you know, or at least to bring you down on the spectrum, because all of these are on a spectrum. But then how do you stay there? People often ask me, what does maintenance look like? And I'm living the maintenance dream, right? And I have for the last 4 or so years. So I talk about this all the time. What does maintenance look like for me? And I think it's wonderful that people want to know what maintenance looks like, because it means that they know they're going to get there.
Yeah, it's a good mindset to have, isn't it?
Yes.
And it brings me on to a question that I really like to ask, because just as you hinted at there, this whole, you know, what is a ketogenic diet? In my mind anyway, a ketogenic diet is whatever you want it to be that works well for you. And so a question I ask is, what does your keto look like on a day-to-day basis? And obviously, by the sounds of it, obviously, because that's what you do, it includes the intermittent fasting. But what I just wanted to pick up on there was that's quite interesting. And I've seen some of your food posts. So I know that you throw in a few things that are slightly higher carb than some people eating a ketogenic diet would. But as you say, because you mix in that intermittent fasting, overall, you stay ketogenic. So it'd be really interesting to hear what that looks like. I had a similar conversation with Terry Lance, and I know, you know, goodness, she eats potatoes sometimes, but she is ketogenic too. So what does your keto look like?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So I don't tell people that I follow a keto diet. I follow a low carb real food diet. I did follow a keto diet, or at least I tried to, for a very long time. And I think it was very effective for me. And I often will, if people are willing to try it, I will recommend that they do that, at least until they feel like they've gotten to a point where you're more metabolically healthy, that you can get away, because some people cannot get away with eating any carbs. their blood sugars will go up, or they'll have major retention and et cetera, the food addictions and all of these things will happen. And so they're in a much better path if they just stay on a ketogenic diet, a keto diet, a low, very, very low carb. And a keto diet, by definition, is a diet where you keep your carbohydrates below 20 grams, at least net carbs. And I think that's pretty much understood, although some people have some variance to that. And so my diet, as I said, is a low insulin diet, which is a ketogenic diet, right? Because insulin, and we show this in our book, how insulin and ketones work in a seesaw fashion. So I'm not trying to raise my ketones. I'm just trying to lower my insulin. And that's how I go about it. So as you said, Terry probably has some potatoes sometimes, and I think she does, and she does quite well. I might have some potatoes sometimes. We fry our potatoes in lard. My kids love it. I have rice sometimes, and that is probably the post that you've seen, right? Like where I throw in my Indian curry sometimes, and I'll throw it in with a bit of rice, or my sardines with a little bit of rice. Most of the time nowadays, I'm doing one meal a day. And one meal a day, it's a topic that people talk about a lot, OMAD, because a lot of people love it, a lot of people want to do it, and a lot of people think it's terrible. So where does OMAD fit into all of this? It probably fits quite nicely in a maintenance plan. It's not a great approach for people that are trying to lose weight. And so I didn't do OMAD before. And I still don't think I do OMAD all the time, but because I do it very often, probably it started off being two or three times a week. And it's probably more like four or five times a week that I'm doing only one meal. And so that meal might have a bit of carbs. You know, most of us have some carbs in the form of vegetables or berries or whatever, dairy. I have it in all kinds of forms. But I have it within that meal, and it's a very rich meal. It's a very satiating meal. And this is so against what I used to do. I could never have a meal to begin with. So this to me is wonderful. It's wonderful that I can sit down like yesterday. Yesterday was Sunday. We have a nice family lunch. And it's wonderful that I can sit down, and I had the same curry that you've probably seen on a million of my posts, because we love this coconut chicken curry. And so it's nice to kind of sit down and have a nice, big, satiating meal. It's nice to be able to walk away and say, I'm done. I'm full. I don't need to eat. I don't have rebound hypoglycemia, which is what I used to suffer from. This is how you kind of know how much you can have. Before, I couldn't have much carbs at all, because if I had just a bit in an hour or two, I would have rebound hypoglycemia and I'd have to eat again. And so right now I know I'm in a good place to do that. But if I weren't, if I were getting rebound hypoglycemia, or if I were gaining tons of weight, or if my blood sugars were going up high, because I still check my blood sugars and they don't move from, you know, 70s to 80s. My A1C is wonderful. My fasting insulin is wonderful. So I know this is a good plan for me. Now I know that my cycles are regular. I mean, these are all expressions of being metabolically healthy. So this works for me. But I also know where I was before. And so when I work with people that are in a different place, you know, we need to have a different conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely changes, doesn't it? What you might need to do at the beginning is probably going to look completely different to what you're going to be doing 2-3 years down the line.
Yeah.
It's an interesting discussion about the one meal a day. I've heard that before, that it's not very good for when you're losing weight, but it's much better plan for maintaining if that's something that suits you. But why is that? Why is it so different?
Well, I think that the intermittent fasting, that kind of describes that you can't be doing the same thing all the time. You got to change it up, right? So what we try to do when it comes to helping people with weight loss is we try to do, and what seems to work out the best, is an alternate day fasting approach. It's an eating day followed by a fasting day. If every day you're eating one meal, then all your days look the same. There's no eating day, there's no fasting day, and you want that alternate pattern. So then an eating day is a day where you're probably eating 2 or 3 meals, depending on the person. I think most people in this lifestyle follow the 2-meal approach. And a fasting day might be a day where you're doing one meal, but many people are doing no meal because, again, you're in your healing sort of journey. You're trying to reverse this. So then probably what works out the best is 2-meal, no meal, 2-meal, no meal. And remember, these are people that have a whole bunch of reserves, a whole bunch of fat that they want to burn. So that makes sense. It makes sense that you would do alternate day fasting, an eating day followed by a fasting day. So then you don't have to worry about, well, my metabolism is going to slow down like on a low calorie diet. No, because on your eating day, you're eating these two very rich, very satiating, high in certain macros, right? High in fat and appropriate in protein. So you don't have to worry about that either. And so the alternate day fasting approach seems to be the best weight loss approach.
Yeah, it's interesting. So it's all about that switching it up and not getting into the same pattern. That's the key component with why one meal a day wouldn't necessarily work too well if you were trying to lose weight.
Because if you're doing one meal a day for weight loss, then inevitably you come up with the same question that people ask all the time. Am I eating enough calories? And this isn't about calories. So one meal a day is not going to be a good approach for a number of reasons. And one of them being that you're going to inevitably be looking at calories and you don't want to. You're looking at insulin and not calories. So there's many reasons why OMAD might not work for a weight loss approach. Not to say that it doesn't for some. For some, it does. And a lot of people say, well, I did OMAD and I lost 10, 20 pounds. Great. But if you had 100 pounds to lose, would that work? I'm not sure. Probably not.
Interesting. And do you find, because presumably it's important, the key important thing with if you're eating one meal a day, and this is why I find that it doesn't suit some people, is that they can't eat enough in that one meal a day and find that they can only eat enough because often your appetite goes down, which I guess is partly to do with the intermittent fasting that you're doing. Often your appetite goes down. So when you're having that one meal a day, it's just difficult to eat enough.
And by eating enough, Daisy, just to clarify, are we talking about calories? Is that the concern?
Well, I guess only really from a point of view, I don't like any kind of calorie counting model. The only way I suppose I would ever consider it is just from an energy value that you need a certain amount of energy intake to get through day to day. This is when we're talking maintenance rather than weight loss.
I'm glad you brought us to that point because I think that's a great point to bring up. So Dr. Fung has a book called The Longevity Solution. I don't know if you've had a chance to pick it up and look at it. But the premise, I think, a lot of different than the obesity code and the diabetes code, which are about reversing certain concerns. The longevity solution is about, okay, now I'm in my maintenance mode. What do I do for longevity? I think it's based on a lot of really good science and maybe anthropological notions that a lot of cultures eat very little naturally. They eat very little. And that might promote longevity. And we know we have this notion of the Japanese, for example, of eating harabuchi, or there's a Japanese expression. I'm not saying it right at all, but I encourage you to look it up. But there's this idea that they eat to 80% satiation and then they walk away. Of course, this is not a weight loss approach. This is a longevity.
Oh, yes. I know that. I have read about that. Yes. To finish just before.
Just before. Because you know that in 5 or 10 minutes, you're going to feel just super full, right? So they eat until just before they're satiated. And then they know that they feel satisfied right after. Again, this is not a weight loss approach. It's not a calorie approach. This possibly is a longevity approach. So when you say, Daisy, and I think this is a great thing to bring up. I'm glad you brought it up. Because people will question this inevitably. If you eat one meal a day, are you getting enough? And I'm saying I'm getting enough. Am I getting enough calories? I don't care. Am I getting enough macronutrients? Yes, I'm certain that I am. Am I getting enough protein? For sure. If you look at your protein requirement, if you're eating an appropriate diet, you're getting your protein requirement. I'm getting my protein requirement, which isn't very high to begin with. I'm a woman. I'm 42 almost. I'm not very athletic, unfortunately. This is my Achilles tendon. And so I know I'm meeting my protein requirement. And how do I know? Because every once in a while I'll check. I just want to make sure. And the same thing with my blood sugars. I check my blood sugars even though I'm not diabetic. I just want to make sure. I check my ketones even though I'm not necessarily trying to get in high ketones. I just want to make sure my insulin is low and so on and so forth. So am I getting enough? I think I'm getting enough. If you're not sure if you're getting enough, then I guess what you have to question is, what are you trying to get enough of? And if you're not getting enough of that, then just try to get a little bit more of it.
It's fascinating, isn't it? I think especially when it comes into this conversation about calories, because if you're thinking about it from a calorie point of view, you're probably going to be eating fewer doing one meal a day. So that, from that calorie counting point of view, seems to be the obvious thing to do for weight loss, except it doesn't work well for weight loss. It works better for maintenance. I just find it fascinating how all these stereotypical things you think about calories just start getting turned on their head.
Absolutely. This is always where the calorie conversation ends up with me. But again, even doing one meal a day, it doesn't mean you're doing low calorie and it doesn't mean you're doing the same amount of calories every day. No. My days are so very different. Even if I'm doing one meal, most days, like yesterday was a huge meal. It was a huge, it was a big family thing. There was a lot of different things, and I do stay within a window though, which is again, intermittent fasting. I won't just eat for hours on end. I sort of start and I stop. Probably if there's an event, I maybe eat in an hour and a half. And most times I eat within 30 minutes or maximum an hour. That for me is important. But again, do I walk away feeling satiated? Yes, then it's all good. I know I've met my required macros and that's it. I feel pretty happy about that. But my everyday doesn't look the same, even doing one meal a day.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's where it's interesting is to start using different markers to assess whether you're getting what you need from your one meal a day or whatever it is, however it is you're eating, forget about the calories. To a certain extent, forget about the macros. Once you know roughly what a plate of food looks like, it's giving you the macros you need. But when you're looking at the other markers, you know, do you have enough energy? Do you feel good? Is your blood sugar good? Is your insulin low? All these are the important markers, aren't they?
Yes.
Which is very different from traditionally what we think of as markers, like how many calories are you eating and how much do you weigh? And that's it. They're the important ones.
That's right.
Where really we should be looking at all these other things, shouldn't we?
Absolutely. And weight, again, bringing up the topic of weight. Weight is not a marker of health. I mean, unfortunately, obesity does tend to aggravate every health concern. So I'm not promoting that people try to be obese. That makes absolutely no sense. And I think most people would understand that that's not what I'm saying. But I'm the perfect example that being thin does not mean being healthy. A lot of the frustrating things that people go through when they're following this type of lifestyle and intermittent fasting is that they're looking at the scale a little too much. Because again, if you were looking at other markers, if you had a chance to do a body composition test, a DEXA scan, and you were to look at your body fat composition change over time and your lean mass composition change, you might be very surprised to see that an intermittent fasting type of lifestyle combined with a low-carb real food approach actually burns a lot more fat. Of course, that's what ketogenic means, fat burning. And that doesn't always correlate to lower weight on the scale. Not if you're putting on a bit of muscle, a bit of bone, which is ultimately what we want. So much more important markers.
Absolutely. We'll put all the links in the show notes, things we've discussed and where people can find you. But perhaps you could just tell us now, where can we find you, follow you, all those things?
Absolutely. So I'm a dietary coach for the Fasting Method by IDM, Intensive Dietary Management Program. So our website is thefastingmethod.com. There you have a chance to look at our program. There is a wonderful community there. There is a way to meet up with people both in the forum as well as in live meetup groups. And we have this coaching option available. I'm one of the coaches you mentioned, Terry. Another one, I think you know most of our coaches. There's a quiz that people can do if they're unsure which coach to choose, which is awesome. It actually leads you to a coach that might be more of your style. I tend to be known as the coach with sort of the right amount of empathy, but with a good kick in the behind. I'm very, I come from the background as a clinician, right? So I tend to naturally be the do this kind of a person. And of course, I've grown, which is wonderful over time. Coaching has taught me how to listen and how to figure out what people need, which is wonderful. But my background has taught me, of course, the science behind things and the how-to and the why-to. And a lot of people that work with me, they want to know. They want to know things. They're very inquisitive. People that we're working with nowadays are not the same as 3 or 4 years ago. Most people are very much in the know. They just need the guidance, the support, the accountability, the cheerleading, the hand-holding. A lot of controversy out there, a lot of conflicting information out there, even within our community. And so people want somebody to help them sort through it. And so this is what the coaching might be very helpful for.
That's fun. There's a quiz. Everyone loves a quiz, don't they? Which coach is perfect for you? And I know there are videos. Each coach has a video.
I don't think we have those anymore.
Oh, are they gone now?
We might implement them back, but because it would be way too much. People would have to do so much homework to pick a coach. So now I think the quiz is much, much quicker, fun. It addresses, I think, most things that people are looking for. And then you get not just one option. I think you get 2 or 3 options. And then you go and you look at their bio. And so you can read through their bio. And of course, my bio tells you a little bit about my background as a, you know, I studied, I did biology. I studied as a naturopath. I worked in the clinics with Megan and Dr. Fung. Tells you a little bit about my coaching style and so on.
Great way to do it. I like the sound of that.
Thank you.
It's been fascinating talking to you. Really interesting. I could go on for hours longer, but I know you have clients to see. So perhaps you could leave us with a top tip.
Thank you. I will. So I work with a lot of different people, of course. I work with men, I work with women, I work with people with diabetes, obesity, PCOS, and a lot of in-betweens. But really my top tip, and I think we hinted at this a lot today, because the underlying, I think, key to my success and to, I believe, most people's success is going to be the intermittent fasting component. So the key thing, regardless of which dietary approach you're choosing to follow, or you find culturally or ethically, right, because this is coming up a lot as well, you're choosing for yourself, then make sure that you eat a meal that is satiating and rich enough that you can walk away. A meal that leaves you needing to eat or craving or snacky in an hour or two is not a good meal. You need to readdress that meal. So this is the thing, full, rich, satiating meals. And that's likely going to take a little bit of tweaking, okay, on your part.
That's a great tip, because it does start ruling out certain things. Yeah, I just had going through my mind there. Yes, that straight away sort of tells you what's a good meal, quote unquote, and a bad meal for you. And I'm just thinking of, yes, the carby type meals are the ones that leave me not feeling satisfied and certainly just wanting to eat more half an hour later. So that straight away rules that out. Whereas you've had something like the kind of meal I had last night, which was really fatty cut of pork and a few vegetables. And yeah, that leaves you feeling satiated for many, many hours afterwards. It's a good indicator.
That's right. And that's how I've tweaked my diet over time.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me today, Nadia. It's been a great pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure as well, Daisy. Thank you so much. Have a great rest of your day. Enjoy. I hope it's not as rainy anymore.
Actually, I tell you what, the weather changed yesterday and we have sunshine and it's due to be here all week. So my saturated ground outside is going to start drying up. So it's lovely to see, because it's just seemingly it's been endless, hasn't it? The rain.
Same here. So we have one whole week of sunshine coming up. A little colder, I think. But
yeah, but that's okay.
Yeah, it is.
It's winter.
That's
I don't mind cold. It feels kind of healthier. And I hope you feel better. I hope your cold goes very quickly.
Oh, I think I'll be fine. A couple of nights of good sleep and everything will be all sorted out.
Just the ticket. Okay, thank you.
All right, Daisy. Take care. Thank you.
To get the resources and links from this show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com/episodes. Please share this podcast with as many people as possible by sharing one of my links or just taking a screenshot of an episode that you enjoyed. Reviews really help raise the profile of the podcast, which gets it in front of more people, but also helps me attract a wide variety of guests. So please take a minute to leave a review on whichever podcast app or platform you like to listen on. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share and comment on my posts. Your support really does mean the world to me. Thank you. Are you enjoying this podcast? Help me make more episodes and videos by making a pledge at my Patreon page, patreon.com/ketowoman. Or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman Podcast website. Don't forget to join in the fun on the Keto Woman Podcast Instagram and Facebook pages, and Daisy_KetoWoman on Twitter. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you would like to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. This week's end quote is from George Eliot. It is never too late to be what you might have been. Happy New Year, Keto Lovelies.